Well, good afternoon, everyone. Everybody's getting their seat and everything. I'll introduce myself, and I'll let Peter introduce himself there. My name is Randall Schwartz. I've been a Dragon Con speaker now, guest for the last couple of years, and really enjoyed it. So this year, I wanted to come back again, and I said, Scott, what should I talk about? And he says, well, what do you want to talk about? And I said, well, right now, and this is back in February, I was doing a huge amount of worm and spam fighting, and it was really fresh in my mind. I said, well, how about that? He goes, okay, that's a topic. That'll work. So that's sort of how this topic got picked. In real life, how many people have a copy of something I've written in hard copy form somewhere? See, so a few of you already know that. Oh, thank you. So for each one of you, that's like, you know, one lunch on you. That's really cool. Thank you. And already prepaid, so that's great. I've written the top 5 selling books on Pearl and written over 200 magazine articles on Pearl, and that's sort of my claim to fame. And I'll talk a little bit more about my role with respect to this talk as we go through the talk. That's probably enough. You can take it from there.
My name is Peter Popovich. This is my first year appearing as a guest at Dragon Con, or any other science fiction convention for that matter. but I've spoken at Spam Summit and at SpamCon before, as well as a couple of other things. I used to be the director of online operations for MAPS. I used to run the team that ran the MAPS RBL, the DUL, and the RSS. I no longer work for MAPS, though, so don't blame me for anything that happened there. after that, I did some consulting. I worked for a while for a company called Mindshare Design, which is also known as Postmaster General, and now they're calling themselves something else. And for a while, Kelly Thompson, also known as Kelly Malloy, and I helped them clean up their customer base. And now we together do consulting services for ISPs and email marketers, helping them understand how they can use email without sending spam. And I refer to this as sort of stealth activism. The thing that I learned at MAPS is that the advice that we offer for free when we were at MAPS, some people took it, some people didn't. But if they were paying for the advice, they took it a whole lot more seriously. And so having consultants out there who will accept money to give the same advice that we all know actually does some really good work. So, cool, thanks. You're going to notice that Randall's going to be working a lot from the board up there because he's got this great case study, and I'm just going to be chiming in from time to time. But
he'll provide the color commentary.
Also, I live in Orlando, and as you may be aware, we've had some complications recently and are having some more right now. So, I may not be going home on Monday. As a matter of fact, I may not even be going home on Tuesday. I'm not sure. But yeah, well, anyway.
Okay, great. So I titled this talk, You Had Me at Hello, Double Meeting, since it's sort of a convention about movies and things like that, so I thought that'd be kind of cute. I probably should explain for those of you who don't know what the reference is to the joke, which means it's not a very good joke if everybody doesn't get the reference. But when a mail server talks to another mail server, it starts with a message that says H-E-L-O and its host name. And that's supposed to begin the conversation. And that's one of the elements in spam fighting, is actually noticing whether that hello message is true or false. Is it lying about who it is, telling the truth? So you had to be at hello. There we go. And also, there's another joke in there, which is that I've spam protected my mail message on a printed handout. I thought that was sort of a bizarre thing to do, but I did it anyway. Right, cute. All right, so give you a little bit of terminology first. For me, what is spam is anything that's unwanted. It's a little broader than the traditional definition of spam, which is like unwanted sales pitches for products that I'm probably not going to buy, especially if they're misspelled. But also, I'm going to define as spam, just for the purpose of this talk, the payloads that come out from viruses and worms from Windows-infested machines that are trying to spread themselves out. So I'm just going to put that all under the category of spam just for this conversation. Most people separate those out when they're talking about spam. And just so I get rid of the First Amendment people here, they go, oh, I have the right to send stuff to you. Yes, I, too, will defend your right to say what you want to say, but not at my expense. Okay, so you don't, freedom of the press doesn't mean everyone gets a free press. I like that's a better way of saying the First Amendment. So, and especially not you using my press to sell me something. Okay, so since my spam, the spam being sent at me, is costing me bandwidth, real time to delete and stuff, you're actually having me pay to hear your sales pitch, and I don't think that's really fair.
One of the points that we made when we were at MAPS is that you have the right to say what you'd like, but you don't have the right to break into my living room to say it. And it's... Right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. If you want to send me a piece of mail, you know, you can put a stamp on it, and that gets to my mailbox. But that's how I choose to receive things.
Another way to look at this is if the sender of spam actually bore the entire cost of the message, I'd have a lot less legal objection to it. But because I'm bearing part of the cost of the message, it's much more closer to, say, a junk fax or a junk cell phone messages, which are illegal in many jurisdictions. To give you a sense of why I'm presenting this talk, I own a small business, my Stonehenge Consulting Services, and therefore I'm the online presence manager, which is really just meaning the janitor, the guy that takes care of the mail server, the web server, you know, all that sort of conversation stuff that goes on. And I have a single machine leased at a co-location facility in Dallas, Texas that I've never seen. I like how we can do so much stuff just over the net. We don't, you know, I have this box and I use this box every day, you know, many hours a day, I've never seen it. I love it, that's so cool. And the biggest expense when I first set up the network system was web. I figured out how much web traffic would be generated by my site, both for just the brochures, the online brochures about the classes we teach. The 200 magazine articles that I've written over the years is all available on my website, gets a lot of traffic. And I've pretty fluent with, well, pretty prolific with digital cameras. So I have about 19,000 pictures from the last 4 years all on my site. That's actually the biggest bandwidth usage, but don't tell anybody that's not really business related. But okay, anyway, so I've got this huge related of all that. So of course that's now on the web and I'm gonna be locked for that. Okay, so at the time, that's what I budgeted for. That's why I figured out what my bandwidth is gonna be. I got a contract with the colo and said, this is what my bandwidth is, at least in theory. So back in the early days before spam, you could put your email address anywhere. You could put it up on a web page. You could put it in a Usenet posting. Usenet, everybody here familiar with Usenet? So I have to find the term. Okay, right, good. All right. Anybody not ever heard of Usenet in this crowd? Hope not. All right, okay. Or in some mailing list. And mailing lists traditionally now get archived. They get put down on websites so you can go back and search them or look at previous messages. So before spam, you could do all that, no problem. Didn't have to worry about that address being spammed to death. But after spamming started, okay, just needed times for the periods. Make up whatever you want from the acronyms, right? If you use an email address on a web page in some sort of, you know, ordinary way that you would say, I've got this message and send this email to me, or even in a mail to especially, or out in some Usenet posting, you could expect hundreds or possibly thousands of messages a day. And that number just keeps getting bigger every day for me and everybody else that has an address anywhere out there on the web right now. Fewer messages, perhaps none, if you can entitize that in HTML, that means turning them into ampersand, pound, number, semicolon, and so on. If you can entitize that, or you can use illegal characters. One of the things we found is that spammers so far are only scraping for ordinary looking addresses. One of my friends actually has an address, a legal RFC 822 legal address of star@qz.to. That's his entire email address. Eli the Bearded, he calls himself online. And he's never gotten a single piece of spam there ever. The spammers are not looking for patterns that look like that, and yet that's a perfectly legal address. Similarly, if I had an email address of randall.schwartz@stonehenge.com, that's perfectly legal, and I would get a lot of spam to schwartz@stonehenge.com, but never to randall.schwartz. They are not scraping for weird characters like that, so that's one way to fight it. So if you just want to take away some takeaways, that's one of the things you might keep in mind. But once an address is in the wild, once it's been scraped once, it's permanent. It ends up on these CD-ROMs and databases of all the possible addresses. It doesn't matter how many times you reply back and say, no, don't send me more spam. Doesn't matter. Once it's in the wild, once you've got your first piece of spam at an address, you will get it there forever. But it gets worse. So apparently the 80 million addresses that have been scraped from the web and from Usenet postings are not enough for the spammers. You know, they say, no, we want to be able to send to 200 million addresses or whatever. So we started seeing a few years ago, it was about 4 or 5 years ago for dictionary attacks, back in there, somewhere in there.
That's about right.
Started seeing dictionary attacks where they would send to just random names at every domain. And they would go down the entire dictionary and stuff like that. So we started seeing dictionary attacks. So even if your name hadn't appeared in any web page, but you happen to have a name that was similar to somebody else's name somewhere, too bad. We also saw the release a few years ago of worms that would go through and look at address books that would because of Windows security holes. We'd go through and look at address books. So even if you're really careful not to put anywhere on the web or on Usenet, you'd still end up, because somebody else had you bookmarked, had somebody else had you in an address book, boom, there goes your address, and now the world has it again because some mail was being sent out with that. And worse. a lot of what was happening was, you know, around the early parts, just like 2 or 3 years ago, people started saying, okay, don't click on something unless it's from somebody you know. Okay, well, now these worms are getting smarter. They were going to the address books. They were taking out addresses that you had in your address book, but they would say it was from you. So therefore, this rule now about, well, don't click on it if you don't know who it's from, no longer applies, because the worm itself was making email that looked like it was from you, and that's too bad. So we started getting a lot of this happening, false from lines. And the bad part about this is that since this hadn't really happened before, there were all these antivirus companies and anti-spam setups that would send back a helpful reply saying, by the way, you seem to be infected. You probably want to look at your machine. I'm still getting about 500 of those in an 8-hour period, so what is it, 1,500 a day, of just these messages coming at me saying, Randall, your machine is infected. My machine is not running Windows. It cannot be infected, okay? So I don't know why I'm getting all these. So what I like to say is don't bounce spam ever. Just drop it. Just throw it away. It's almost likely going to have an illegal from anyway. So just drop it, people. Don't bounce it back. If you have antivirus software that sends email back, yell at the manufacturer, upgrade. Most of them have slowly come out of that phase, right? Do you know of any antivirus stuff that still sends stuff back? Or?
There's still a lot of stuff that has yet to be upgraded, but I don't think any current versions do that.
Yeah, okay. So it's just really annoying. So please, I mean, I'm getting a lot of stuff that just, and the trouble is that's all in different formats. So I had to create these huge proc mail recipes to throw those away. And everyone just said a different way, like, well, your machine's affected, or this machine sent an illegal attachment. I go, I didn't send any attachment. Merlin at stoneinge.com does not send attachments ever. I don't know what these guys are talking about. Anyway, it's crazy.
One of the other things, and this is for those of you who run Qmail out there, accept then reject is one of the most evil ideas that I've ever heard of in my life. I don't understand it really. and I've seen it a lot. And I get a lot of bounces that way too. It's like, no, really, I wasn't trying to send mail to your unknown user, and I don't know why you accepted it. Why didn't you just, delete it or reject it during the RFC conversation? But if you're going to reject, reject during the RFC conversation.
Yeah, SMTP conversation.
SMTP conversation.
Too many TLAs in this whole talk. Sorry about
that. Yes. Well, we were talking about RFC 822 earlier.
I know, right. Exactly. Okay, so now let's spam at some point about two and a half years ago started being a significant portion of my inbox. And that's annoying because I really want to get work done. And I really want to have the probably 150 valid emails I get a day not get swamped by 600 bad messages, and the number just keep getting higher and higher. Now, part of the problem is that because I had a wildcard domain, stoneinge.com, I wanted to process that. Initially, it was everything at any user for stoneinge.com came to my user ID, Merlin. I just had it all forwarded to there, mostly for legacy reasons. And in 2002, I took that procmail script and I added, as one of the steps before the final delivery, I added a call out to Spam Assassin. Now, what Spam Assassin does is it looks at the content of the message for things that are likely to be spam. So, messages from Nigeria, things like that. It kind of looks for that sort of standard patterns that people say in spammy messages. It also has the ability to look at, and this is something that Peter can speak to a little more directly, it looks at RBLs, relay block lists, real-time block lists.
Real-time black hole lists.
Okay.
Well,
so
it depends. I mean, really,
I don't know what
the thing is that the Maps RBL, of course, was the first, and by that, and now it's the Kleenex of black hole lists. And, the generic term, of course, is DNS BLs, or other blocking lists. Yes. Yeah, that's
something like that. So what those were is a real-time way for Spam Assassin to go out and say, okay, I have a message from this address, 1.2.3.4. Okay, is this likely a bad guy? And so these real-time lists would tell in real time, that's likely to be a bad guy. We've gotten reports of spam from there. We've got reports that it's an open proxy and all the various other things that we might do. Now, what Spam Assassin does is it goes through and does all these checks, and each check has a weight added to it, a +1, -1, +3, -3, stuff like that. It would add up all the scores of everything it found out about a particular message, and if the score exceeded a certain threshold, boom, it put it in the spam can. And otherwise, it would sort of pass it along, and there was various options controlling it. So I had a fairly conservative Spam Assassin setting. I think I had it like at 10. It would actually drop the message at a score of 10, and it would warn me between 3 and 10, and below 3, it wouldn't even notice it on there. But that was actually pretty cool because just using that setting, I was able to get my unwanted mail down to about a third of what it was. So instead of having, you know, 600 to 1,000 bad messages a day, I was down to maybe like 200 messages a day. It started being on parity again with the actual valid messages I was getting every day. I was happy. So that was my first settings. That was about 2 years ago. Yay. See, okay. All right. Then came the MERVs. The MERVs, the actual definition of MERV is a multiple independently retargetable reentry vehicle. So that's the official definition. Now, in the spam world, what I mean by that is that spam would come in addressed to many, many users within the Stonehenge.com domain. So it would address it to like Merlin at Stonehenge.com, comma, Randall at Stonehenge.com, comma, Fred and Barney at Stonehenge.com. In other words, a number of addresses. Now, it's convenient for the spammer because they send one payload. They have one SMTP transaction, and there's 10 envelope sending addresses. But it would eventually explode into 10 messages at my system. It'd be separately delivered. And the way I had this set up is it was actually coming split up to my proc mail because every address was looking different from the postfix, which explode them out. I would get 10 invocations out of my proc mail, which would then be 10 invocations of Spam Assassin. So they came in clusters, too. Of course, it's one message being exploded at 10, so all of a sudden I go boom, 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 and my proc mail would get invoked 10 times in a row. My Spam Assassin connector would get invoked 10 times in a row. I would do the same checks, the same expensive checks with the relay lists, with all the rules and regular expressions over and over again. So separate Perl invocations, really messy, really ugly. So at first it was just some load average spikes. And I first noticed this when the MERVs started coming around as just all of a sudden my load average would go up to like 9 and then back down to 1 or half. And then back up to 9 and then down to 1.5. I was like, what is going on? I'd be watching. Of course, you know, when the load average is 9, you can't really type anything. And by the time you type PS or a top or something, those are all gone. These were such short-lived processes, but they'd all hit at once, and they would definitely suck my CPU down. But after a while, the MERVs started becoming the main source of spam coming in. And I was having a continuously bad load. It really sucked. I almost couldn't do anything on the system. And that was for my web services, my mail service, interactive, it's where I read IRC, that kind of stuff. So it was really a mess. So I was trying to figure out what to do next, and I was consulting with the other experts in the spam community, trying to figure out what to do, and I kept bitching, what do I do, right? So in mid of 2003, I moved my Spam Assassin out of the proc mail script, so it wasn't getting invoked once per message. I moved it into the mail transfer agent, in this case, postfix. Now what that does is it actually gets a chance, using MOVISD, to keep Spam Assassin in memory and to actually see the message before it gets split up. That meant when this MERV comes in, it's got 10 delivery addresses, but it only goes through Spam Assassin once. Huge improvement. Handles a MERV before it bursts. And also, it means I can reject the spam because it's still in the pre-delivery queue. I can reject the spam during the handshake, so I didn't even have to bounce the spam. I could actually do what I really wanted to do, which was tell the sender, okay, that's bad, but I'm telling the real sender, not the from address sender, which would be the wrong person to tell. So it got it more closer to the right step now, and it really was a big savings. Actually, I Googled around to find the solution. I didn't find anything exactly the way I wanted to do it, but enough pieces of it were in place that I was able to put the process together, and I ended up writing a magazine article about it, and that's available if you Google around for it. I'll give you the reference at the end. So it gave me a bit of relief for a while. Life was good. I was actually livable. Now that I had Spam Assassin moved into my MTA, life was okay. This was good from about September 2003, when I first implemented this and tested it out, down to about February of 2004. Spam was slowly increasing during that period of time, but manageably, and they didn't catch a typo on that. Oh well, mangably. Maybe that's what I really meant, mangeably. Right, so it was okay though. Spam was just, it was still okay. And then the invasion of the worms. This is probably appropriate for a science fiction convention to talk about this, right? All right, so worms, ick, okay? Right, worms basically were Windows infestations. Windows system would be corrupted by some sort of incoming mail or incoming web page access, things like that. And it would basically cause the system to become a worm spreader. Now, initially all these worms did was they created themselves and spread themselves out. There were also many variants from like March to February or March of 2004 to what about June? When the sort of the last few variants started hitting. But it was like there was like a new variation like every other day. Some new thing would come out, some, you know, the Nagel worm, the Doom, My Doom, just a huge list of stuff that came out through there. And the antivirus people were like releasing new press releases every other day. That's really slowed down though. So I think probably just that they got tired of it, right? Or what?
I think so. I think that some of the antivirus stuff got smart enough that it's detecting the variants before.
Right. Oh, that was
well, and also
arrested one guy. Yeah.
And also for a while the variants were like, you know, we'll change a few bytes and re-release it, you know, just to get around the.
And the one thing that's interesting about these worms is that rather than try to send mail through the standard mail user agent and mail transfer agent on the box, they included their own mail transfer agent. They could go out directly and build the TCP/IP connection to talk to other mailers around. So they could do their own policies, their own connection rates. They could do things like 10 simultaneous deliveries to my poor machine. You know, so they started doing some really annoying things. Or they weren't trying to be nice. They were trying to be nasty and get out there. And so the mail pack payload they sent out was a fat payload. You know, it had a big long .zip file in it or .exe or something like that. And of course, it was from an address that the person would trust. So they'd click on it, and all of a sudden, their box would become infested because of that. And it was usually rapid fire. I don't think the worms were using MIRVs, but they would hit my machine like really fast all at once. Boom, 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 boom. A lot of different hits all at once to the same IP address. And their ultimate purpose was twofold. One was to spread. So they were promoting their own existence to machines all over the world. But the second is that they were actually, based on analysis that we've seen, they were actually there out there to create millions of zombies. These are machines that are essentially spam relays for hire. So what we have is, what's the estimate, 45 million, 70 million machines?
I don't even know.
Some N number million machines are sitting on high bandwidth connections like DSL and cable modems all over the world right now, right today, that for the right price to some guys in Germany or the Ukraine or someplace can be spam delivers for any product that you want. They
absolutely
lie and wait.
Absolutely. Yeah. There is a market for owned boxes, and it is absolutely scary, the number of owned boxes, because, you know, they're running unpatched Windows crap. And
without unpatched, that fits.
Yeah, well, okay. Once you patch it, at least you get a fewer worms, or fewer of the worms will work. But
that's true.
Can I get you to digress for a moment?
Okay.
Do you think these millions of zombies will help you with real-time blacklists?
Well, I would.
Some of them are very well-managed. Some of them can force me to change
I'll be talking a little bit about some of the shortcomings of RBLs later on in the talk, and if I don't cover it, please do bring that point up again.
Yes, definitely. But what was happening then is, see, all these zombies are getting created out there, and I was getting mail from all of them with this big worm payload, which didn't help me again because I'm like now, and the biggest problem with the worm payload is panic, right? Okay, that's usually the first response. So what I was looking at was the worm payloads. I was saying, okay, there's got to be a way to blow this out. Spam Assassin didn't know about them, and they were changing every other week. But I was watching for procmail recipes that I could use to at least keep them from being delivered to my inbox, which was pretty useless in the first place. So that kept my personal mail sorter from being invoked on worm payloads. Now, the steps in my delivery is that anything at StunEngine.com gets delivered to my procmail. I've got a couple of worm filters in there, and then I've got another Perl script that actually figures out what mailing list it came from. Whether it's something that needs an auto reply, how often the auto replies get sent, a lot of policy issues about things that mail that comes in to me personally. So I have that in there. And this, now that I put the worm blocks, the worm filters in my proc mail, at least those weren't getting invoked for the worms. And I, at one point, I tried to teach Spam Assassin about worm payloads, but when I'm under the gun, I'm not very smart. So I wasn't very smart about this. I just said, screw it, I've got it in proc mail, RC, it's good enough for now. Okay, because the nice thing about Spam Assassin, teaching Spam Assassin to do it, is that would have moved it earlier before the MIRVs, but MIRVs and worms tended not to come together. The worms were simply single deliveries, so that made it wouldn't make that much difference to me. But now I had a new problem, bandwidth. The load average wasn't bad by the time I wasn't invoking Perl on every single worm payload that came in. But my port 25 bandwidth, my mail bandwidth, far exceeded my web traffic. I have graphs for that period. I don't have any on the presentation. I'll just do it in the air. Where, like, here's my mail load, and here's my web load. It's like on top, like about like that. It was like maybe 10 or 12 to 1 over the web bandwidth. And when I bought the box originally, I had based my total colo costs based on the highest possible web bandwidth I could ever use. So I was way over that. It pushed me way into overage charges. I mean, and we're talking pretty expensive, because when you book with a colo, they want to know kind of what your average, you know, maximum will be, and then they buy all their upstream based on that. And if you start going over that, you're stealing from somebody else, so they're going to charge you an arm and a leg, kind of like when you buy cell phone minutes. And
it's
then you
it's
go
the
over
Sprint
the
commercial.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, now I need you to tell me right now, how many megs of spam are you going to get this year?
Right. Right. So it was, exactly. So my contract was, I was going into this very expensive overtime up in my contract. But luckily, thank you, SprocketData.com, that's a colo. I got to say it, because they didn't charge me anything. And during the three-month period that I exceeded by triple my actual allocation, they just said, look, we know you're fighting it. We know everybody's fighting it. Yeah, we're actually paying more to our upstreams because we have fractional numbers on some of our links. So we're paying more over. But he said, you know what, we'll just eat it. There's got to be a break at some point here. Somebody will figure out how to make it better. And I was actually talking with them about some of the solutions I was thinking about putting in place. They said, just do it and let us know how you do it. We could tell our other customers. So part of what I've been doing is actually giving them technical information that they're sharing with their other customers. So thank you, SprocketData.com. There's their plug. Okay. So I started to fight back with filtering, because I said, I can't accept a worm payload and then delete it, because by then I've already sucked down the bandwidth. I've already taken the bandwidth and used it up for the worm payload. But it's great. I run OpenBSD in my box. I run OpenBSD because I like to sleep at night. Okay. OpenBSD has a reputation of being the most secure. Whether it deserves it or not, I don't care. It seems to have the reputation to be the most secure, and for me, it's just been real great. But one of the things that OpenBSD has is this really wonderful packet filter system called PF. And PF is great. It does both very, very detailed, complicated, filter on source, destination, all the usual things. It also has a good traffic shaper in it. So I can actually say, for this category of packets, I'm only going to allow, 10 megabit a second or something like that. It allows me to adjust all those around. Okay. And another thing it has in it is it's got this really nice way to have very, very large lists of IP addresses that can be scanned very efficiently. It's got some really nice tree algorithms in there. You can basically have a filter that scans through 100,000 IP addresses in real time, and it figures out whether this is yes or no based on things. Very, very cool. The guys have worked very hard on this to make it work. And they can also be dynamically updated, which is also very cool. So my goal was look for people that are bad to me. And I'll define bad in a second, but I only get one chance. Only get one chance to be bad. So once they're bad to me in any way, shape, or form, they no longer can be bad. And by that I mean they would go into my port 25 filter, and I'd not hear from them for at least a while. Okay, so I said, one chance, you're out of there. So bad boys. Who are the bad guys, right? I had to figure out who was being bad. Who would be in that category? I actually picked initially three categories. One was that. I have a bunch of addresses in Stonehenge.com that were never real addresses. They simply became addresses associated with these, 80 million addresses on a CD kind of thing. And because of that, I could say any email sent to that address was absolutely spam. I mean, there's no doubts about it. We call these spam traps, and they're very useful in the spam fighting community. Very nice. And the reference there is that for a while there was this company called Stonehenge Internet Services in Colorado. They were a dial-up provider. Okay, now they couldn't get Stonehenge.com, which is very clear when they went to the DNS, and there's my name in there 4 years earlier. Okay, so they said, well, we can't get Stonehenge.com, we'll be Henge.com. Okay, but here's Joe Blow signing up for his internet access, and he asked them, he says, what's my email address? Well, it's your address at Henge.com. But of course, he doesn't remember that by the time he goes and types it in to his mail configuration system. So he sets it up as joblow@stonehenge.com. Okay, so he starts sending email out to all of his friends. And how do I know this happened? Because all of his friends would then write him back saying, hey, cool, you're on that. That's pretty cool. Of course, it comes into my box, my bounce box. And I would write back and I go, no, there's nobody here named Joe Blow at stonehenge.com. Well, some of these people would even post him on web pages, post him in Usenet before they were told the right solution. And so they became spam traps. I have about 45 polluted addresses from this company in Colorado that thank God went under. Okay, because I don't have to worry about this anymore. Just a slight aside though, there is another company. Can I say this is all recorded, isn't it? There's another company that called Stonehenge Capital. They're a big funding company. They're a big, what do you call it? VC. They're a VC, right. Okay, venture capitalists, right, exactly. And their addresses are all at StonehengeCapital.com or StonehengeOK for their Oklahoma office, .com, okay? About once a week, Now, what kind of email would be sent to a venture capitalist? About once a week, I get a payload sent to an address at stoneinge.com that contains business plans, financial data, credit reports, high-level names. And I try to reply to these. I have an automatic filter that looks for those kinds of things and replies back and says, why did you send a message to, it isn't the standard bounce message, why did you send that to there? Maybe it was a virus that sent it, but I also want to know why you sent it in case it's important. And people write back to me, they go, well, because he told me that's what his address was. And I'd say, okay, give me his phone number. I don't care about your name anymore. I want to call him and go, idiot. Okay. It's been weird. Okay, that was a digression. But yeah.
One thing that happens with this, I have more domains than I really need, but because for a little while I thought that would be a cool hobby. But
the entire set.
The one thing I've noticed is that the shorter the domain name, the more likely it is a misspelling away from some ISP somewhere. And when people give out their addresses, they, you know, they're human, they mistype. So you end up picking up a lot of, I've got a 4-letter.net. There's I have a friend who has ho.net. So, but there's, you get some bizarre stuff. When you're misspelling away from something, and it's, you know, whether or not you actually aim for a misspelling away. I'm not talking about the guy who got, like, you know, AOM.com. I'm talking about, you know,
yeah, just stupid people.
Yeah, people who just type badly.
The one other thing I want to say about HingeCon before I move off of them, and again, thank God they're gone, is they had both Hinge.com and Stonehenge.net. I actually got internal memos from one part of the company to another that was misaddressed. That's just, anyway, they were just losers.
Yeah.
I got bought out by Earthlink. Not that that's going to be any help to me. Anyway, so moving on from that. So that was one of my categories. Anybody going to a known spam trap? Anyone sending spam according to Spam Assassin? Those are bad. Bad boys, if they send me spam, and I set the threshold fairly high for that. I think I still have it about 10 or so, which is still pretty confirming. So anyone sending spam, and anyone sending a worm payload. So now I've got all these different devices that are detecting bad guys, and they're all writing log files. So what I did is I wrote a Perl process that sits in the background and watches the log files from PostFix, that's the one sending it to spam traps, from AmavisD, which is if Spam Assassin says bad, and procmail from when I was looking for a worm payload. Worm payloads were dropped out in procmail. So I had things watching all these log files, keeps up, watches, and it scans those looking for the IP addresses of the questionable party. And what I did is I took that IP address and I added it to a port 25 block. That meant that the moment somebody sent something to one of my spam traps or sent me a worm payload or whatever, boom, port 25 says, nope, you're not even gonna connect. It doesn't even look like there's a connection there. There's no way to connect back to that again. Now, I automatically remove all those after 2 hours. Why? Because it might have been that a piece of spam came through a corporate gateway to my box, and then that I would be blocking that corporate gateway for everybody else trying to send to me for forever if I didn't take it back off. If it's a legitimate piece of email, then the mail server, once he sees that my port 25 is off, he's gonna put it in a queue to retry again every 15 minutes or an hour or 2 hours or so. 2 hours for me, I've played it with it a little bit lower, a little bit higher. 2 hours seems about right in terms of my comfort level of having them blocked and my comfort level of getting back legitimate mail when it has to come through. So it's important also to realize that I already know that I'm blocking more than I should be. I already know that, and that's why the policy is set up the way it is, okay? Keep that in mind too. And it gets legitimate mail to flow again.
One point that I think it's probably worth stressing at this point, you're not allowing an SMTP connection and then giving back a 5XX return code or a 4XX return code. You're actually refusing to even allow the connection to be made, which to a sending mail server looks very differently. I don't know
if that looks like
the server is down, and I don't know if that's a fairly subtle difference if you're an end user. But in terms of system administration and actually how the mail servers get designed, that's a big difference.
That's actually a useful difference, yeah.
Yeah, and it's a useful difference to take advantage of.
Right, exactly. And what we noticed, though, is that the moment you put up a 25 block, they may bang on worms. They may bang on it for another 10 or 12 tries right away, but they'll go away. And even if they came back within 2 hours, they're going to get that same block again. in. So what I'm effectively doing is telling the worms, hey, nobody here, really, there's nobody here. You can go off and go try one of your other 20 million addresses, 20 million IP addresses that you can possibly compute from what you've got in
right.
your tables.
What about the opposite
of that?
A tier group?
A tier group is a connection where you allow the connection to be made, but you respond to every iteration of the conversation very, very slowly.
Ah.
Which means that if they're trying to open connections, you know, lots of connections, you allow them to make all those connections, but then you say, you respond to them as slowly as you possibly can. Exactly. Tier group is tar
okay.
pit.
All
it's
right,
the same.
Yeah.
yeah, tar baby.
I thought about that for a little while, but I like my way because it just immediately just shuts them off. I don't want to tie up my resources tying up somebody else's resources. I just want to move on.
Right.
You know, maybe somebody with a few more spare resources than I have can try that. That's great. Thank you. Thank you for doing
right.
that, but it won't be me. Okay, so let's start now. I went back one page here. Okay, so the results were actually rather nice. My email bandwidth was reduced by half almost immediately putting this in place. And all of a sudden now, you know, my mail traffic and my web traffic were sort of in parity finally again. They're both about equal. And at this point then I was skimming the valid limit of what I was buying from the colo. And all of a sudden he's going, wow, what did you do? And I said, well, I described this to him over the phone. It was like, yeah, well, that's cool. All right, so tell us how you did that, and we'll help all the other customers out. And I said, well, it's a little complicated. You got to be running OpenBSD. Okay. So, you know, you got to understand Perl. You got to run Spam Assassin in from AmaVisD and PostFix. So not really reproducible. But for the people that were, I was able to give them guidance on how to implement at least parts of this. But that's great. So now I'm not worrying every day that I'm going to get a $600 overage charge for this month's bandwidth, which is really nice. It was livable. And I'll tell you, this is how effective this is. At any given moment, 24 hours a day, there are about 750 to 1,500 bad boys in my list. So these are people that within the past 2 hours have sent me worm mail, spam, or email payload, a worm payload of some kind. Yeah, this is just in the last 2 hours. And they roll out and roll in.
Did you have a log of how many connections you were refusing?
That's coming up.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
All right, yes, that's also scary.
That's the interesting number.
That's getting there too. I said, hey, now I'm within the limit. I can actually use my box again. My load average is down to something reasonable. My ISP is not yelling at me for burning up all their overage charges up the stream. So I said, okay, OpenBSD packet filtering includes a really cool thing as of the most recent release, which is passive operating system fingerprinting. Based on the way the initial connection packet comes down and how it's formed and what the features of it are, you can actually tell that it was being sent by a Windows box, for example. Interesting, okay? This is based on the publicly available P0F code that's been out actually for a couple of years, and you can build this as a library that you can hook it into other applications and things. But it's built into the packet filter on OpenBSD as of the last release, and I was really anxious to try this on something. So I just decided Windows is evil. Why not, okay? So slow down all the Windows email. What I did is I created a queue that's the size of a dial-up modem, 28.8, okay? I watch for all incoming connections to my port 25 port, and I assign them collectively to this one 28.8 link.
Oh my gosh.
They all fight over a modem. Why slow and not stop? There's your question.
Why not 14.4?
28.8's actually, when I was cranking it down, at some point it starts complaining that it couldn't send back NAC packets quick enough to even make a difference. Yeah. So this was sort of the threshold of how low it could actually make a difference.
This is kind of the tier group.
Yeah, right. Okay, why slow and not stop? Because some of my friends actually run Windows. I'm sorry to admit I have a few. Don't wave your hand, Bill. All right. And they want to send me email. Okay, and some corporate mail gateways run Windows. Okay, so
there
I
might be a paying client.
There might be a paying client somewhere that's going to write me to say, please convert us to Unix instead.
Yeah.
Right.
Please,
so
God, help us get off of Windows.
So, right, so I don't want to totally blow them off. But here's the net effect of this. Besides being just a cool thing to do, and boy, I tell you, I got back mail when I posted this to a couple of the mailing lists. They went, oh my God, this is cool. You know, yeah, but I do it. So I posted the actual, it's like 10 lines of code to add your PF Cuddle script. Okay, very cool. So the net effect, though, is that most of the worms were slowed. That meant that I could get that first payload in and get it through my analysis system before the second one hit, because I was slowing down all that. But legitimate mail still tended to trickle through kind of when it got a chance to get through this 28 link. So we liked it. We really liked it. And again, this is no work on my part, no extra. Excuse me? I can hear that.
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, it just distracts me when I hear other things. That's okay. Okay, it's all managed by PF. I don't have to do any work. It's not like I have to have an active program, go out and look at the IP addresses, then analyze them, see if they're Windows, then go back to some filter. No, it's all PF just does it. It just says if it's Windows and if it's port 25, boom, go into the tiny queue. So it really is cool. Very cool. All just by configuration change. Now, here's the cool part. Here's the thing you were referring to. Who was I blocking? So, of course, packets that are being blocked, I had them logged, and they get logged on OpenBSD to a thing called pflog0. And you can tell tcpdump to go off and look at pflog0 and tell you in real time what's popping up in there, what packets are being blocked or delayed or whatever. Now, tcpdump on OpenBSD has been modified to include the same passive fingerprinting that's available in the packet filter itself, so I can actually watch those fingerprints in real time. Bad boys are still attempting to connect to my box. So this is the people in the 750 to 1500 IP addresses at any given time are still trying to connect to my box 30 to 90 times a minute. Now, I want you to understand what that's actually saying now. That means 30 to 90 times a minute, I would have been accepting an entire mail transaction. And instead, all I'm saying is, I'm not here, I'm not here, I'm not here. 30 to 90 is a really short little packet that just says, you know, nobody home. Okay. That's cool. That's where the extra bandwidth is coming from. I'm not even having a transaction 30 to 90 times a minute that I would have had otherwise. Now, almost all the connections were from Windows machines. We figured there's the zombies that are out there trying to get to me and deliver me extra worm payloads or extra spam from these owned machines. So very, very cool. It's fun to watch the list because there's like different versions of Windows and stuff. An occasional Solaris, an occasional Unix. Now, why did those get blocked? Probably because they had spam that came through a corporate gateway. So I'm watching those pretty carefully. But this is proof that it's working, and this is proof also of the other conjectures that it's really a bunch of Windows boxes that are causing most of the spam on the net. I'm seeing it 30 to 90 times a minute. Yeah.
When you block them this way, are you being completely silent, or are you sending back an ICMP message that says this port isn't open?
I believe it sends back an ICMP that says it's not open.
You might consider just being silent, because that still has the effect of server down, but you don't use any outbound bandwidth, and the bad guys will take longer to figure out they timed out instead of moving on to the next thing right away.
It's quite possible. If I could figure out how to... I'm a bearer of very little brain, so if I could stare at the PF manual just a little bit longer, I could probably figure out how to do that. But, you know, right now I'm just doing the things that are really blatantly obvious from the PF manual, you know, so, and the PF, unfortunately, PF is one of these really cool things, but any, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, you know, so you have to kind of sort your way through all the documentation on it. It's so, yeah, if I could figure out how to do that, I'd probably do that. Silent answer probably better on this.
The prudent way is to use it on the outbound side to block the ICMP messages
themselves. Right, right.
Regardless of why they're generated.
Exactly. Okay, so, but why stop there? Let's keep going. Okay, I also looked at my postfix documentation, which again is pretty thick as well. So in my spare moments, I was looking at this. I noticed that postfix had one of their spam settings was they could block transactions coming from unknown hosts. These are unknown hosts, means that when the connection comes in, it's got an IP address that's needed and mandatory, but the IP address using the DNS system would be turned back into a name. And then for double check, you know, double secret probation, they would then take that name and turn it back into an IP address, and it better darn match the IP address they had. So it goes through a double check every time. I enabled the test that said, don't let unknown host talk. And I added that block in mid-2004, about a couple months ago, and my email was reduced by an additional 70%. Now, why did I add this? Well, first I asked around a bit, and they said, yeah, this is a pretty effective thing. Because most of those wormed machines, most of those zombies are sitting on somebody's home system. There may be an IP to host name translation for most of those, but there almost always is not the host name back to the IP address again. I'm not quite sure why, but it doesn't go full loop anymore. So that is enough to detect that these are mostly on, you know, Comcast and Earthlink and other home DSL setups, Yahoo DSL, those kind of things. It's in that category. Okay, and once again, SMTP was dwarfed by web traffic. My picture now looks a lot like it did, you know, 2 years ago. Yay, back to where, here's mail, here's web, exactly what I originally purchased the system for. Load average normal, everybody was happy. The downside of that, though, is that reverse DNS should be set up for all corporate mail gateways, but some very large companies aren't doing it right. I have a client whose main job in life is DNS, and he was embarrassed because he couldn't send mail to me because his DNS company didn't have the right reverse DNS for their mail gateway. This is, I won't mention the name, but it's the third largest provider of DNS in the world. Very scary that they didn't have the right address. Yes. Well, it's going on tape, and I want them as a client, so I can't say it. All right. So I did add. Luckily, Postfix allowed me to have a whitelist for that stuff. So I have tools that go through all the block things because of bad reverse DNS. Every day I look at that. I look at the top rejection list, and if it looks like it's from to incorrect, and I take the IP address and I look at it in the relay block list to see if it's something that's like really a known spam guy just trying to get through. And if it kind of gels as being a serious address, I then add it to my whitelist and I let it go. But that's a manual process. I don't know how much of that I could automate because a lot of it is judgment calls all the way down the line. So I'm just going to leave it the way it is for now, and we'll just leave it at that. So this extra workload that I think is worth the result, the fact that I'm able to throw away an additional 70% of my email. So another takeaway from this is if you don't want to do all that other junk that I say I'm doing, okay, just add this one check and then be willing to watch the logs a little bit. Be willing to have a whitelist for the thing. You'll get rid of a lot of your email right there. So that's a good one. Okay, the other thing I just implemented recently I'm rather happy with, and it's sort of an interesting test. When mail gets delivered, you can tell through the DNS system that, okay, here's the machine it's supposed to go to, and here's a machine that if the first machine's down, you can deliver it to it as a secondary. The primary has what we call a low MX value. The secondary has a high MX value. Now, you don't have to set up a secondary, and in fact, recommended these days, you don't even do that. If your machine's on the net most of the time, don't worry about it. This was back in the old days, when machines are on the internet maybe 4 hours a day or something. This is so there had to be some way to get the mail even when it was disconnected. But nowadays, when you've got 24/7 on or you've got some relay that's dealing with it for you, don't even set these up. But a lot of people still set them up. Okay, so officially, the mail is supposed to be delivered to the lowest MX value that's active at the time. But what we've noticed is that a lot of the spam software delivers instead to the secondary rather than the primary, either first or even just only. Now, this violates, of course, the internet standards, but that's what they're doing. They don't care about the internet standards. They're just trying to get the mail delivered to you so it's in your inbox so you can buy misspelled Viagra. You know, that's really all they're trying to do, right? And the reason the spam software does this is that the secondary machines are rarely configured to have the same spam blocking setups that you do. And here's the problem. Once it's delivered to the secondary, when the secondary delivers it to you, let's say you're looking at the IP connection, well, you have to permit the secondary to send mail to you. So you end up with entirely the wrong rules to be applied to this guy who's just forwarding legitimate mail to you officially. It sort of blesses the email and sends it along. That's exactly the wrong response, but it's exactly what the spam people are counting on. Gets around the spam blocks. But because it's being delivered to the secondary, not the primary, it's also a valid spam sign. It's something that has a high degree of correlation with spam in the first place. And there's been some discussion over the last 6 months to a year about, okay, well, that means you could probably set up a machine somewhere over here that all it does is be a high MX number for the for your domain, and then any mail delivered there is probably bad. But a lot of people hadn't figured out yet, and I sort of stumbled on a good way to do this, is, well, what if your machine really is down? Then all the mail is going to go over there and get rejected. Oops. You know, you'd be rejecting legitimate mail. But here's what I came up with. I just put another IP address on the very same box. I mean, either they're both up or they're both down, okay? There's not really by any chance that you're gonna have not delivery, right? Okay, so they're both up or both down. Okay, and I gave it a name and a high MX value. Actually, what I called it is spamtrap.stonehenge.com with an MX value of 666. Thought that'd be kind of cute. So I did the ones like 10 or whatever my standard address is. Okay, and then I taught Postfix to listen separately. Normally it listens to all, which means just as a wildcard listen. But I said, okay, listen separately to blue, my machine, primary machine name, and set a spam trap using different configuration files. So now I could configure that secondary, that virtual secondary, whatever way I wanted to. So I told it, for anything that connects there, it sends back a 450 violation of RFC 2821, section 5, paragraph 8, and that really is the actual section that says deliver to the low MX first. Now, why is that in there? Because I want legitimate mail being sent there. If some postmaster somewhere sees this mail being rejected, it'll actually tell them right where to look, and that's the whole details of why it should be delivered low MX first. So I'm doing the right thing. I'm telling them exactly what it is. Now, could a spammer read this and figure that out? Maybe. Do they care? Probably not. They're not going to rewrite their spam software not to do this. They're going to say, well, there's one clever person out of a billion that we're not going to get mail to now. They're not going to worry about
it. If AOL, Yahoo, Hotmail, Earthlink do it, then or Microsoft, then perhaps they'll change their delivery mechanism. But for you, they won't.
Exactly. And so therefore, that I'm doing, it's all working really well. And it, no extra work, just a change in a few configuration files. No extra software to do this as well. Just configuration a little bit in PostFix. I'm actually going to write this up as a writing and mail it to the PostFix mailing list. So hopefully it'll be part of the PostFix facts. PostFix facts? That's really hard to say. All right. FAQs. All right. So the caution again is, in order to use this, you must make sure that the HiMX wasn't a legitimate sender rolling over. But it's the same host in my case. So they're both up or they're both down. It's really hard for it to be one or the other. And also return a 450 or 452 was being discussed on the list. I don't know what the 452 would be better. But anyway, 450 code, that means a legitimate sender will retry, hopefully getting the non-spam trap the next time. So you do want to return a code, just do it again.
Now, you run a separate postfix process?
Yeah.
So you have to be absolutely sure that they either start together and end together.
They're both in the same master.cf file, though.
Right. Okay.
So, yeah, it's pretty likely that it's either all up or all down. Okay. Yeah. Most spam centers will just go away. Now, what's the results of this? Check this out. I just implemented it a few days ago, so I don't have a lot of historical data on this, but I'm blocking 90 messages an hour just from this one little check. That's pretty cool because, the nice thing is that those, and no false positives. I've been staring at what it blocks, and every one of them is bad. Every single one of them is bad. Very, very cool to get something that's 100% false and false positive free. 0% false positive. There we go. And the other thing I'm doing, though, is I'm also adding these to my bad boy list. So once somebody gets blocked because they went and touched my, knocked on my high port, they go over to the low port, nobody there for 2 hours. Back to the same list.
Do you also block them from reconnecting to your high port?
Yeah, it's just blocked across the board. Yeah. So
of these 90 messages per hour are retries?
Exactly.
Okay.
They can't be. Yeah.
Okay. So that's 90 unique.
So I also mean that it's probably even better than it looks. It's probably also preventing me from getting spam through the other system as well, and maybe anything else that's coming from that box. So very, very cool. Now, since I have a bad boy list, I said, what if somebody else wants to play with my same numbers, see what that use? I actually have an RBL set up. I call it an RBL. I should call it DNSBL because RBL is really like an official. Oh, well, whatever. Anyway, I have this set up. So you can actually add that like you would add a relay blocking list to your own spam assassin or something. I update it every minute using dynamic DNS. So you can actually see my 1,400 addresses that are being blocked right at this moment. Please ask, though, before using it, you're going to be using up my bandwidth. So, this whole reason is to not have bandwidth be used. So, if you use it and you want to play with it, feel free, but just tell me you're using it so I know if I'm going to move it around. It also gets published. If you just want to see at a given moment, you can download this URL, and it's the same thing as a text form, one line per IP address. It's currently being blocked in my bad boys list. Some lessons I learned from this, though. I did try, and then I abandoned domain verification on the hello line. This means that when a system is talking to me, the first hello line that comes in, I wanted to make sure it was a valid domain name that had a valid MX and a few other things. Every check I added, I got way too many false positives. There are a lot of people who do not know how to set up their mailers. And this is something that's a lot more about an individual mail administrator rather than somebody that's a DNS expert or something. So it's more likely to get messed up and it's broken. So don't use that. It's just too many false positives unless you have some way of also having a huge whitelist out of that for all of your friends that are broken. I also eventually want to look at a longer history of these IPs that keep ending up on my bad boys list. I want to maybe have a longer hysteresis before they get pulled back off or something. But you know what? It's working well enough. I'm down to the point where my mail load's good, my load average is good. I have very few false positives, mostly from that unknown host things being sent. Maybe a few from the spam assassin kicking in a little too high. But it's workable now, and it's 1/50th of the load that was coming in before I did any of this. And that brings me well within limits, well within operations. So what is the cost? I mean, you got to hear, I spent a lot of time making this work. I spent a lot of time talking to other experts. They've spent a lot of time making this work. I mean, there's all these people working really, really hard just to make it so that mail looks like it did in 1998. it's not progress, okay? I would have paid real cost and bandwidth. Every time the load average went up to 10, I was sitting there on the box trying to figure out how to reconfigure something or shut the mail down for a while. I can't tell you how many times I typed postfix stop in the last year, because I just said, and then I would start it and it would just go, postfix P, come on, echo P. it was just nuts, I see that too loudly. Okay, and this is just for one box, single domain, think of the cost at AOL, at Earthlink, at and all these people that have to deal with this on thousands and thousands of domains, all the extra costs involved. Of course, this kind of stuff would actually scale fairly well. So some of the, you know, put in once, it might work for many people at once. And also false positives cost me real business. That guy I'm trying to get as my client who has the misconfigured outbound email system, for a week, he wasn't replying to my mail. And I thought, oh, did I piss him off somehow? And he called my office and he said, I'm trying to send you mail, but it's getting back an error message. Of course, when I finally got a hold of him, I said, did you read the error message? And he said, oh, it says unknown sender. I said, oh, I bet you don't have a valid reverse. And he goes, oh my God, we're a DNS company that doesn't have a valid reverse. It was pretty embarrassing for him. But okay, but you know, so it cost me real business. If he hadn't been really wanting me to do his work for him, you know, that could have really cost me. And what's funny is that he actually understood. He said, you know, I've been a BOFH too. I know that I have to set my box tight or things get messed up. So it was great. So we had good rapport out of it. But I'm lucky. I don't know how many others I'm losing simply because something was messed up, as much as I'm watching that. My dream, of course, I know there's going to be arguments about this, but you know, junk fax is illegal, junk cell phones are illegal, junk email should be illegal somehow. And I know the accountability chain and stuff makes it hard, but it's just my dream. Okay, in my world, in Randall's world, you know, junk email would be illegal. Also, culpability for operating system producers, read Microsoft, for failure to adequately build and test security based on actual damages. I bet I could get together, the head guy at AOL, the head guy at Earthlink, the head guy, and we could just make a collective lawsuit if there weren't so many lawyers at Microsoft. I bet we could justify the case. Right. Yes. Yeah, so if they took down the Department of Justice. Okay, whatever decree there was is just now null and void, effectively. I mean, it's going to be hard to do this. But this, again, this is my world, my ideal world, because my real world, Microsoft wouldn't exist. But at least they would be accountable for this. They would be accountable for the cost it's made to me. Okay, and also, regarding both of these, you know, I have a chain of responsibility. It's estimated that about 85% of spam benefits some U.S.-based corporation, even if the spam comes from outside the country. So look at the chain of command. If it actually benefited a U.S. company, then the U.S. company's responsible. That gets around the international part of the law. It's like, okay, you're ultimately benefiting here, and it would be on the onus of the company then to say, well, wait, no, we didn't even like authorize that, and they'd have to prove it with disclosure and stuff like that. So that'd be interesting to do. That's, again, my dream. I'm not a lawyer, so I know how good this would be all support.
For those of you familiar with junk fax law, this actually isn't all that different from junk fax law. I mean, this is very close to what, you know, yeah. And so
maybe someday. But yeah, well, it's, mm-hmm. like I said, the number I heard was 85%. That 85% of the spam is actually somebody in the U.S. pushing some button to tell somebody to send it, whether that intermediate chain was U.S. or not, doesn't matter. It was like 85% was benefiting U.S. companies, so therefore they should be held responsible.
Right.
Yeah.
Through an open proxy in, you know, Korea. Yeah.
Yeah. It gets a little tricky. Anyway, so last page for resources there. If you Google for your site, stonehenge.com, spam, you'll see everything I've written so far about the thing I made with MFSD and the postfix adjustments and stuff like that. So I wrote an article. So actually, although this has cost me a lot of time and money, I've made $800. So that's not bad. Okay, so it offsets it just a little bit. All right. I've also looked at the documentation for postfix. There's stuff in there about the resource controls, MFSD, spam assassin itself has some really good documentation about what it's doing and stuff. OpenBSD's PF, if you can kind of work your way through that, that'd be another thing to look at. You can also hire me to help you set this up in your company. So that'd be there too. So that is the end of the formal part of the talk. And now,
I was gonna talk a little bit about there were two things that I wanted to talk about today, and I don't have slides because first I'm, you know,
I'll do hand puppets.
Yeah. First I'm a little bit of a slacker, but also it really has been an interesting month living in Orlando, because you know I can't. There was a while I couldn't even access my own box. Anyway. The two points I want to make, and this serves really well as an example. Real-time black hole lists, RBLs, DNS-based blocking lists, you know, DNS BLs. Show of hands, who here is familiar with them? Who uses them? Who runs ISPs? Who runs mail servers? Fantastic. Okay. DNS BLs, or blocking lists in general, have been, in the past, incredibly useful tools. That you can use them to block certain types of mail. You can block them And I'm going to use the examples, the maps, the three maps lists that I was most familiar, you know, that were there when I was there as the example. The RBL was the list of IPs owned by people who were associated with spam somehow. The DUL, which was a list of dial-up users or dynamically assigned users. There were some DSL lines and some cable modem users in there, but they were DSL lines and cable modem users for whom their ISPs said they should not be sending mail from this IP. They should be using our, you know, the ISP's mail server. And the RSS, the Relay Spam Stopper, that's a list of open, unprotected sites that will relay spam for pretty much anybody, although you might have to take advantage of a hack. The fourth category is open proxies, which are like open relays, but different from a technical perspective. Generally speaking, most of the relay lists I've ever been aware of are either one of those four categories or some combination of those categories, some aggregation of those categories or lists, the aggregation of lists that have those categories. I'm sure there must be somebody out there, you know, and then there's the I don't like these people. It's run by a guy who collected all of the IPs that he didn't want mail from. And well, no, you have a tech. Now, the thing is, if you document exactly how it is that you come up with those IP addresses and you stick to that document, you will rate yourself in a very, very, very small subset of blocking lists out there. At MAPS, we were really, really serious about if it fits the criteria, then we'll list it, or at least we'll consider listing it. But if it doesn't fit the criteria, then it cannot be listed, you know. And that was one of the serious rules at MAPS. We played fast and loose with a lot of rules, but that particular rule, it has to fit the criteria to be listed. That we were pretty serious about. Here, you've come up with a list that meets a very specific criteria, and you can document it, and you do document it, and you are clear. It's not personal. It's not, you know, it's not about the fact that I don't like you. It is specifically, you did this. This IP address did this, and so therefore it is on the list. When you choose to use a blocking list, or your ISP chooses to use a blocking list, that's really important, because some lists are run by people who end up with this great set of criteria, and they say, this is what we list. And that works right up until they get really, really, really angry at. And how many people have heard of Forbes? Yeah, and yeah, and the thing is, you know, no, well, the thing is, you know, really, spam fighters, we're all assholes, okay? No, really, when you talk about spam, when you talk about spam fighters, you are talking about people who are so angry about spam that they will happily spend 2 years of their lives underemployed, spending their lunch hours, you're talking about people who are really angry. There is rage. There is rage beyond rage.
Out of necessity.
Or they're just nuts.
Oh, okay.
Okay. No, really. I worked for a couple of millionaires who blew their millions. You know, and you got to be nuts to do it. You have to be like damn near certifiable. But you're talking about people who are really angry. And the thing is that some of these people do not know how to channel their anger consistently. And so and it only really takes once or twice before you ruin the reputation of your list by adding things that don't meet the criteria of the list, which then alienates your users and then ultimately causes the downfall of your list. And that's how you lose lawsuits. That's not how MAPS lost lawsuits. But you know, there are other users who have lost lawsuits because, you know, that, and I don't even think Alan Brown's allowed back in New Zealand now. But it's one of those things, you know, and it's sad when it happens. But that's how it happens. So if that is the shortfall. If the list does not adhere to its criteria. And it does not, you know, it does not remove the entries that it's supposed to remove. It does not, you know, when you fix the problem. Sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. I do know the guys you're talking about. That is a tough order, because you've moved several times. I don't know that I could recommend a specific way of finding an ISP that isn't on any DNSBL, because there's 25, 30 of them in common usage from when I last checked, and some of them are pretty small and some of them are aggregations, like I said, but that's a tough one. First, most ISPs don't use really aggressive lists. Most ISPs realize that they're bouncing too much mail that their customers want. So the first thing I do is talk to your user, find out what they're, look at the return codes that you're getting when you try to mail them from that server, and find out what's happening there. Document why it is that the mail's not getting there, and then have them talk to their ISP. Because there are a couple ISPs out there that will aggressively block anything that even remotely looks like spam, according to any of the blocking lists out there. And it's tough for them to keep users. But the thing is that the system administrator is thinking about his own email box and not about his customers' email boxes. And when that happens, the loss of customers is really about the only way that problem gets, that. Sure. Right. It can be, but really you got to be pretty technical. Yeah, it's right. 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 I have not done any work for, and you're talking about like the Norton has a product for that, and there's a couple of them. And no, I am not currently doing any work with any of those guys. And trust me, if you want to send them my way, I'd be more than happy to make the point for you. But there is the other thing I wanted to talk about was a little bit about Bayesian filtering. And I'll talk about that in a second. But really, there comes a point at which the user has to be responsible for how they filter their mail, or picking an ISP that filters their email appropriately. And there are some ISPs, they're not big ISPs, because they can't be big ISPs, because, actually, there are a couple of big ISPs who do some very bizarre things. The other thing I've done, in addition to working at MAPS, or the other big thing I've done, is I've worked for some bulk email service providers, companies that send bulk email on behalf of their clients. And their clients tell them, no, these are people who have asked for my mail. And the definition of asked for my mail is one of those, forgot to turn off a checkbox is one of the definitions. And now I've worked for MAPS, okay? Double opt-in, fully verified opt-in, closed looped opt-in. I am a big fan, it's all the same stuff, and I am a big fan of it. But the thing is, in the business world, you can't sell it to everybody. God, I wish we could sell it to everybody. Mm-hmm. It would make the world a much better place. But you can't sell it to everybody, and so then you've got to figure out how do you know? And the thing is, and some of it just isn't. Some of it wasn't asked for, and it just wasn't asked for. And because they're including things like presidentwhitehouse.gov,
verified too.
And So then you start looking at some of this data, and the things that do and don't deliver, and the things that the ISPs that have their various standards, and the lists that you do and don't end up on when those clients have those problems. It's really interesting because there are clients who have had problems and got on lists, and I mean they were legitimately problems, and they realized they were problems, and they terminated the customers, and they cleaned up their act, and they moved on in many different ways, and not only the difficulty that they had with the blocking lists, but also some of the difficulties that they had with the big ISPs. There were some interesting, I mean, it's interesting talking to the guy who, you know, for dollar largest ISP, it's really interesting how those conversations go sometimes. And it's not always exactly a straightforward discussion. But again, really it's about how your ISP chooses to filter your email. And for the user that isn't receiving your discussion list, depending on who the user is and depending on what percentage of your list it represents, you may end up having to have that discussion where they have to talk to their ISP. And
see, the problem is, on any discussion list,
right.
5 to 10% of the people subscribe to the list participate in the discussion.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I have no idea how many lurkers are not getting these messages.
Yeah, but it's the lurker who's interested enough to have the conversation with you, who is also going to be the same guy who will talk to his ISP. One of the things that I learned is, and I've learned this a couple of different ways, if the users are calling their ISPs and therefore generating support costs for the ISP, a lot of ISP will make their decisions purely, like beginning and ending of the decision ends with how many calls does this result in. And the larger the ISP, the more that becomes a big issue. If they end up counting, you know, multiple hours a day of support time across their entire support staff to a particular issue, that issue gets fixed. And so that, call your ISP, talk to them, show them the bounce messages, start using their tech support to solve this problem. Once that cost goes beyond a certain point, the system administrator ends up getting overruled on his decisions. And I've seen that work both for and against our cause. You know, for good lists or bad lists ending up in, you know, not getting used, and also sometimes, unfortunately, good lists not getting used. But and ISPs putting pressure on the list that their personal fandom list of choice, you know, saying we'd love to use you, but you got to fix this one problem. You have to stop, you have to stop listing stuff that doesn't meet the criteria, or you have to allow another chance before and document it so that my users don't come to me asking why I'm blocking their mail, you know, why I'm blocking mail to their inboxes. There's a lot of that happens. The other thing I wanted to talk about, I want to move on because we're like actually, over. Is Bayesian filtering. Long term, the profitability of spam, I think, is going to be affected more by Bayesian filtering than anything else. And I've been working with CRM 114. It is not for the weak of heart. It is not for the technical newbie. It is a, you know, CRM 114 and Bayesian filtering in general at this stage, I think, is very powerful technology that is where the programs are written by people who really understand the technology and really don't understand how to implement it so that it can be used easily and aren't really even to the point where they can establish the scripts that a sysadmin would want to make it easier to integrate to the, you know, to mail software. And that stuff is starting to happen, but over the next couple of years, I think we're going to see a lot of Bayesian filtering and a lot of ISPs using it in ways, whereas an RBL or, you know, black hole list in general is one company or one person saying this list of ISPs is bad and therefore ending up at some certain amount of risk for having said that. You know, and the risk of being sued to try to, you know, influence their decision. It, when companies are able to make those decisions for themselves, or a company's users are able to make those decisions saying, you know, it's not just one user said this is bad, it's 500 users said this was bad, and so therefore we integrated it into our Bayesian filtering algorithm, those kinds of things are going to be much easier to defend legally. And those kinds of things, I think, are going to change the nature of spam, because it's going to change the profitability of spam. And when AOL starts saying, AOL has already got the "this is spam" button, but when the shaping of what mail gets accepted or not is based a lot on the Bayesian filtering. I think that kind of thing, and plus it's real time and it's reactive, and it's based on user preferences. That I think is gonna change where the profitability of spam is, and that's the cool technology for me. Anyway,
I'm wrapped up. So
yeah. Well, I mean, but other questions for him.
I wanted to ask, if you've got questions, could you please come up to this mic and stand in line?
Oh. Yeah. Okay.
We wanted to get this on the recording.
They want we can repeat the question also. I mean, if yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I do that normally. Yeah.
Sorry for dominating the discussion. I came here with an agenda. I really have been in the midst of a lot of the spam controversies over the last 7 years, and it's just driving me nuts. At any rate, during Randall's presentation, he talked about zombies. 45 million zombies out there are now programmed to send spam at the press of a button. And I'd like to know how the zombies are going to impact the blacklist operators, but the good ones and the ones I don't like.
Well, do you have an answer for that? Because I mean, I could.
Well, one of the things,
talk about it in general.
I mean, it's going to be hard to keep noticing every single owned Windows box out there,
right.
You know, because these RBLs are the real time lists are not updated automatically. They're updated as a result of somebody filing a report, somebody else looking at it, saying yes, that really was a piece of spam. Okay, we're going to add it. But by then, you know, that box may have even been on a dynamic address.
Mm-hmm.
So, who, you know, he's logged off, logged in, and now he's on some other address. So it's not really going to help at all. A system like what I've created here, I have actually, I think at this very moment, I've actually turned off all RBL checks. I don't even bother now having spam assassin go out and ask, is that a spammer over there? As far as I'm concerned, I've brought my mail load so low, down to tolerable limits for me, that everything I'm doing works. So when I had my spam assassin real-time checks turned on, I had to I was actually getting an increased net traffic because every mail that came in, I had to then go ask two or three lists, what do you like about this guy? What do you like about this guy? Do you like this guy? And that was actually extra traffic, and it actually took up more time on my DNS, more CPU load, because my DNS would have to go out and make the queries, and you know there's a long chain of what it has to do just to get to one address. And so, you know, it's for me, the RBLs are becoming less and less interesting to me, just because of that.
I think there are some blocking lists that deal with like open proxies and open relays, and there are some ways to programmatically test whether or not something is an owned box, but not all owned boxes are owned in a way that is externally visible from the network, and when you're talking about those kinds of boxes, I'm not sure that there is a way that that DNSBLs, that IP-based blocking lists, are going to be able to keep up with that, because you can't tell just by looking at a piece of mail. From in some cases, especially programmatically, in kind of the bulk processing that you need to be able to do to make it happen in real time, that's going to be a really tough thing to implement. And it may be that some guy is going to crack it and figure out, you know, certain classes of owned machines that are detectable, but I don't think in the long run that's going to work out. That's again, it's one of the reasons, that is yet another reason I think the Bayesian filtering in the long run is probably going to be the next step in the arms race.
What about just simple port 25 blocking at the ISP level?
Well. Yeah, but how does the ISP know that the IP that and the question was, how does an ISP or will an ISP? How about if an ISP just blocks it at port 25? An ISP blocking their customers from connecting outbound on port 25, is that what you're talking about?
Exactly.
That is a very valuable tool. When I worked at MAPS, I was the king of port 25 blocking and port 25 redirection. Port 25 blocking means that your users that your end users can't connect outbound to port 25 because they're not allowed to. Their mail is supposed to go through your server, and if their boxes get owned, they just can't connect out. Port 25 redirection is at the router redirecting their connection so that it goes to your mail server, and then your mail server passes it on, and that way you've got logs. Because if you don't do something to track outbound port 25 traffic, you don't know when your user's box is owned. And port 25 redirection at least gives you, you know, you can do some traffic analysis, you can do some, you know, you can do some internal filtering. Right. And you know, port 25 blocking and port 25 redirection, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, was the hot thing. And a lot of ISPs have gone that way.
I've got 30 to 90 packets a minute that tell me that it's not being done enough, though.
Well, but I mean, you know, but several major ISPs went that way, and that did have a noticeable effect, because it stopped the guy who had the dialer who would dial his way through the ISP's modem pool, and that was at the time, that was a substantial effect on the spam load. There was like another dollar big ISP when they did it. There was a huge change in what we saw with spam, and that was roughly 2000, 2001.
I was going to ask, what have you thought of cross-referencing your bad boy list against Aaron to find out who these people are coming, where they're coming from?
I do a lot of spot checking. The question is, have I thought about cross-referencing the bad boy list that I have with the actual bad guys? I do a lot of spot checking. So I will take the list and dump it out and pick an address at random out of the middle, and I'll go to the black hole list master page that I can check against about 20 lists all at once. And a lot of those come up thumbs up on a lot of them. So, but not all of them. Some of them are green lights all across. Like, they've never seen anything from that. So I could actually contribute to the world. But again, I don't want to do that blindly, because I'm not keeping quite enough statistics yet to show why it ended up on that list for 2 hours. I have to go back through like three separate log files to find that. So, I mean, here I am, a guy that writes software for a living, that can't write software fast enough to do this. So, I mean, enough time to do that. Yeah. I can tell you the ones, when I watch the real-time blocked packets, which is probably a quick way to get a quick summary of what that is, almost always it's China, Korea, Comcast, and what was the fourth one? There's a fourth big one. AT&T. So, but Comcast keeps coming over and over and over again. So, I would not block your specific IP unless your machine was owned. You know, that's the thing. I'm not blocking Comcast in general. That'd be nice every once in a while, but no, I'm not blocking Comcast in general.
And again, it comes back to, he does exactly how he documented it. The list works exactly the way as described.
Yeah. It's only 2 hours. Yeah, and then you're back in.
The question is about Bayesian filters that were effective and are starting to be confused by misspellings. I've noticed that too. And I fell into some really bad habits in terms of training my filter. If you stop training the filter, then it doesn't know that this new type of spam has come through, and it doesn't add it to the Bayesian mix. Have you been,
no, I've been
constantly retraining it?
Mm-hmm. And I'll get in 100 messages 100 different misspellings of Viagra.
Yep.
Maybe they're really different products.
And it's all like essentially the same rough format of the message, but I don't know, you know, it's like, and you can still read it, but the current popular thing is where like the letters at the end of the word are kind of at the same place, but they sort of randomly stir up the middles of all the words, but your brain puts it back together again.
And again, we're talking for the purposes of the people who are listening to the tape later. Oh God, what did I say during this? That no, really, until you've been sued, you don't think about the various things that you say in various forums that will come back to haunt you,
or have a criminal case against you.
No, yeah, well, just the deposition. Okay. A deposition is one of those things. But again, about the misspellings, I don't. The thing is that Bayesian is cool, and Bayesian works, and I've seen the numbers, and I've used it, and I believe in it, but there's enough magic in Bayesian that I don't fully understand the technology, and so I don't know whether the internals of a Bayesian engine is not my forte. I deal with the policy issues, and But I'm not sure exactly what the issue there is, but I know that Bayesian has been effective on a lot of the misspelling stuff, and whether that's based on format or whether it's based on something else the Bayesian engine is detecting, I don't know. Some of it, some of it is just how the headers look, because the headers themselves end up becoming part of the Bayesian mix.
Yes,
it's just bytes. You know, it's just bytes and separators, and the Bayesian engine knows what to do with it. And so some of that, I think, may just be based on how the headers look.
We need to wrap it up.
We're
over. Yeah. You've got another panel, right?
Yes. When we were talking about the legal issues, at 11:30 tomorrow morning in this room, there will be a discussion about the legal side. Pete Welburn, who is a really good attorney, who has done some really, those of you, there are people nodding out there in the audience, but he's a really good guy and he's local. And I'll be back again to talk about some of the legal stuff as well.
And also, if you bring up a couple of questions about what I talked about today at Hacking 101 or Hacking 201, I'm sure I'll take them too, because it is about hacking in a larger sense. So it's tomorrow, and then there's one tomorrow, was one Sunday night. Yeah, they're both in the evening.
It's on the back of your badge.
Oh, it's on the back of my badge. It's on Saturday at 8:30 or Sunday at 10. So
for those of you who ever run conventions, this is the coolest thing ever.
Absolutely.
Print the speaker's schedule on the back of his badge. Oh, well.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
I want to thank you all for your attention. Thanks for coming, and hope you got something out to take out of this.